You know the truth about Santa Claus, right? That question came from my brother, a whole year older than I was. His words like a challenge, a gauntlet thrown down in the days approaching my sixth Christmas. I mean, you know the truth, right? My mother looked on in this conversation with a dubious expression. "I'm not sure he does," she said with some hesitation. "Sure he does," my brother went on. "He knows. He's got to know, right?" "What do you mean?" I protested. "I know. Of course I know. I've known for a long time." "Know what?" "Know that Santa Claus isn't real," he said as he slipped in the Christmas dagger. "That it's really just Dad dressing up," he said, twisting it a little inside my heart. "Come on, you're kidding, right? You've known that." "Yeah. Yeah," I mumbled, "I know." And without moving a muscle on the outside, I felt my soul tremble. That I was able to remain standing at all, that I was able to hold my head up and keep from crying in that moment, that was my initiation to becoming a modern-day Christmas participant. It wasn't hearing the news that my brother brought that qualified me. It was the fact that I was able to remain completely composed and even fake a smile which said that I was ready to be cheerful around great disillusionment. It's something that we've all become quite practiced at if we have lived through very many Christmases in our culture, especially if we happen to have been raised Unitarian, like me. I say that because it's been my experience of Unitarians, at least my generation of Unitarians, that we often understand ourselves to play an important role of modern-day soothsayers or truth-tellers who deal with the discomfort and the ambiguity of confusing stories by stripping them down to their barest facts and then presenting them very publicly with footnotes that are annotated and bibliographies that explain all of the facts. And one story that the Unitarians have scrutinized with little mercy is the story of Christmas. When it comes to Christmas, Unitarians invented Scrooge. Literally. Charles Dickens was a Unitarian in England when he, in the weeks before Christmas of 1843, published A Christmas Carol. And ever since, Scrooge has become a standard bearer for Christmas pragmatism. And there are good reasons to have such pragmatism, to be sure. Because any holiday that will tell you and justify and have parents say to their children, "You better not shout, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why." Or have this character go around putting your name on good lists or bad lists. And just imagine the idea of a Santa who sees you when you're sleeping and knows when you're awake, and offers threats of coal instead of presents if you're bad. Certainly, all of these aspects of Christmas stories should be imbibed with great moderation. These scenarios will never appear on anyone's good parenting lists, for they reveal manipulation and coercion. And ironically, it's manipulation that is turned back onto the parents, pressuring them in our culture to buy so many presents. Unitarians are rightly wary of stories fraught with so much embedded coercion. So perhaps, at the risk of stripping away the magic within some of these stories of Christmas, I'd like to shine a little historic light on these stories and see what turns up. You know about Santa Claus, right? The legend of Santa Claus can be traced back to a monk named Nicholas, who was born sometime around 280 AD in Patara near Myra in southern Turkey. Much admired for his piety and kindness, he eventually became a bishop within the Roman Catholic Church, hence the bishop's hat and the mitre and the flowing gown and the white beard and the red cape. It is said that later in his rule, he decided to give away all of his wealth and travel the countryside, helping the poor and the sick. And one of the best known stories about Nicholas is his saving of three poor sisters from being sold into slavery by providing their father with the dowry so that they each could be married. Legends tell of him of either dropping off bags of gold down the chimney or throwing nuts and sweets through the window, which landed in the stockings which hung over the chimney to dry. After his death, Nicholas was venerated as a saint, becoming Saint Nicholas. Stories of Saint Nicholas spread, but after the Protestant Reformation, Protestants were reluctant to honor a Catholic saint, so the various countries came up with their own legend of people who were gift givers. In Scandinavia, a jolly elf named Joltmanten delivers gifts in a sleigh drawn by goats. English legend explains that Father Christmas visits each home on Christmas Eve to fill children's stockings with holiday treats. Pierre Noël is responsible for filling the shoes of French children. In Russia, it is believed that an elderly woman named Babushka purposefully gave the wise men wrong directions to Bethlehem so that they couldn't find Jesus. And later, she felt so remorseful, but she could not find the wise men to undo the damage. And so it was said that seeking redemption, Babushka visited Russian children in their home, leaving gifts by their bedsides in hope that one of them would be the baby Jesus and she would be forgiven. Christkind, or Kris Kringle, was believed to deliver presents to well-behaved Swiss and German children. Christkind, meaning Christ child, is an angel-like figure who is said to accompany St. Nicholas on his holiday missions. St. Nicholas didn't actually make inroads into North America until the end of the 18th century. December 1773 and again in 1774 had newspapers reporting that groups of Dutch families which had gathered together to colonialize New Amsterdam, which we know as New York, honored the anniversary of St. Nicholas's death, which was December 6th. St. Nicholas, over the years, had become known to the Dutch as Sinterklaas, but the newspaper's grammatic and inaccurate spelling led to the North American name, Santa Claus. In 1822, Clement Moore, an Episcopal minister, wrote a 56-line Christmas poem for his three daughters entitled An Account of a Visit from St. Nicholas. Moore's poem, which he was initially hesitant to publish due to the, quote, frivolous nature of its subject, is largely responsible for our modern image of Santa Claus as a right jolly old elf with a portly figure and the supernatural ability to ascend a chimney with a mere nod of his head. Although some of Moore's imagery was probably borrowed from other sources, his poem helped to popularize the now familiar idea of Santa Claus who flew from house to house on Christmas Eve in a miniature sleigh led by eight flying reindeer whom he named each personally, leaving presents for deserving children. Moore's poem created a new and immediately popular icon in American culture. A few years later, in 1881, political cartoonist Thomas Nast drew Moore's poem to create the first likeness that matches our modern image of Santa Claus. His cartoons, which appeared in Harper's Weekly, depicted Santa as a rotund, cheerful man with a full white beard holding a sack laden with toys for lucky children. It is Nast who gave Santa his bright red suit, trimmed with white fur, North Pole Workshop, elves, and it was Nast that even gave us Mrs. Claus. Gift giving, mainly centered around children, has been an important part of the Christmas celebration since the holiday's rejuvenation in the early 19th century. Stores began to advertise Christmas shopping in 1820, and by the 1840s, most newspapers were creating separate supplemental holiday sections that advertised features of toys along with this newly popular icon of Santa Claus. In 1841, thousands of children visited a Philadelphia shop to see a life-sized Santa Claus model. And of course, from then, it was only a matter of time before stores began to attract children and their parents with the lure of a peek at an actual Santa. In the early 1890s, the Salvation Army needed money to pay for the free Christmas meals that they provided to needy families. And so they began dressing up unemployed men in Santa Claus suits and sending them into the streets of New York to solicit donations. Those familiar Salvation Army Santas have been ringing the bells on street corners in America ever since. Now I want to pause at this point and share my hope that the information that I offer expands rather than reduces your Christmas world, because my intent is not to squash the imagination or the inspiration that emerges from that original character of St. Nicholas. That's not the point of the telling. There is an irony here also that I want to share with you, and that is that much of this information that I found about Santa Claus came from a website entitled Santa Claus, the Great Imposter. And it was a very thorough website and created by Dr. Terry Watkins, Ph.D., for his Dial the Truth ministry. And like me, he asked in very bold letters at the top of his website the question, "You know the truth about Santa Claus, right?" The difference between me and Dr. Watkins' website was that he interspersed stories of Santa Claus with quotes from the Bible and ancient theologians. He quoted passages, quote, directly from the authority of the Bible's gospel narratives, which tell how Jesus was born in a manger of a virgin mother. He was promoting how the birth was foretold by prophets and attracted wise men from afar, guided by a star to witness the miracle of birth in the season of darkness. It was his aim from his website to lift up his belief that shepherds came from their fields to visit the baby in the manger because there was no room at the inn, and how a heavenly host of angels sang in great chorus around Jesus as he came into the world. Watkins' clear motive in exploring, quote, the truth about Santa Claus was really to discredit any alternative stories that in his mind threatened to undermine Jesus' rightful place at the center of Christmas. And here too, Unitarians have weighed in on the truth around the Jesus story. There are thousands of websites beyond Unitarians that go into contemporary theology that shine a historical light on these stories and shed fact from truth. Since the dawn of written history, it has become quite common for followers of any particular prophet to elaborate the miraculous details of that prophet's birth and life in order to upgrade his importance. For instance, you will find much information abounding about legendary figures like Hercules or Osiris or Bacchus or Mithra or Hermes or Prometheus or Perseus or Horus, all who share a number of factors that are claimed for Jesus by Christians. For instance, all of these characters, along with Jesus, were believed to have all been male, all lived in pre-Christian times, all had God for a father, all had a human virgin for a mother, all had their birth announced by a heavenly display and celestial music, all were born on or around December 25th, all had an attempt made on their life by a tyrant king while they were an infant, and all had been visited by wise men during their infancy. There is much information from historians and archaeologists who also point out that it is impossible to say what time of year Jesus was actually born in, because it was not a custom of the Jewish culture to keep track of and celebrate birthdays. Birth dates were rarely recorded by anyone except a few pagan cultures, and religious scholars have been able to trace that the date of Jesus' birth was not even first announced until 300 years after his death by Emperor Constantine. He declared it to be December 25th to draw attention from the popular pagan celebration of Saturnalia, a solstice festival. Today, many folks, especially Unitarians, just want to know the facts, the historical truth, what really happened. But what we have to remember is that what we understand to be historical fact today was a concept completely absent from the Mesopotamian culture from which these stories arose. There were no newspapers in Mesopotamian culture. There was no public hall of records. There was no 60-minute exposés. There was no fact-checking at local elections. Historical accuracy was not the compelling ideology that it is today. When stories were told, they were built up over the years by people who passed them on because those stories lifted up the imagination and inspired the people to a truth more powerful than fact. Today, we have lost our appreciation of that kind of truth. In our understandable efforts to protect ourselves from manipulation and duplicity, in an attempt to feel more powerful, we have employed the practice of finding facts to strip stories of their myth and legend. And nowhere is that more notable than among Unitarians exploring the Christmas stories. But we must remember that Dickens' intention in writing A Christmas Carol was not to give us Scrooge as an exemplary holiday pragmatist. Dickens wrote this story as a counterpoint for the puritanical view of Christmas, which was very solemn and dour and pious. He exhorted the people instead to seek joy in Christmas, to be inspired by the birth of hope and kindness, and he gave it as an admonition to seek a larger truth than just fact and reason and profit and the bottom line. A few years ago, I was thinking of this and remembering that fateful day back when I was six and the struggle that I had when my brother told me the truth about Santa Claus and about what I needed to do to figure out what really was true. And as a response to that, I wrote a Christmas story of my own to deliver to the children of my church that I served back in Monterey. And I'd like to share that story with you. There was once a man, Nick, who suffered a terrible accident. And because he had no family and no money, he was taken to a very poor hospital to recover. The man was once an artist, but now found himself blind. And when he awoke in a strange hospital and realized what had happened to him, he fell into great despair, questioning even his will to live. The injured man was put in a room and shared that room with another fellow, Joshua, struggling with his own maladies. And understanding the despair coming from another human being, a conversation was struck up between the two. Joshua could tell quickly that his new friend struggled, unable to see not only what was around him, but what was within him and what was in front of him. So he began telling Nick of what was going on in the world outside the hospital. He told Nick about what he could see looking out the window by his bedside, and he described lots of workers constructing festival grounds across the street. It was a Christmas festival. He described each new development as he saw it happen. The large tree going up, the lights, the games, the booths with food, the children, the laughter, especially the laughter. All this happened over the course of days and weeks as Christmas approached. And being an artist, Nick developed a picture in his head of that festival as it was emerging. And it gave him hope. And that hope gave him strength. And he began to recover much more quickly. And then, one early evening, as Joshua described the unfolding events of the festival, he described two things that really caught Nick's attention. "They are about ready to put up the star," he said. He saw how they were having trouble and described that it was difficult to put into place. And then he said something odd. "They just put up a very large sign that reads, 'Help Wanted.'" "I wonder what they're looking for," Nick asked. Late that night, the two men spoke softly about the Christmas memories that they remembered from their growing up, and how Joshua remembered the star, and how the star reminded him of one of his favorite hymns. And he sung that hymn. "Oh, star of wonder, star of light, star with royal beauty bright, westward leading, still proceeding, guide us through this perfect night." And shortly after, the two men fell asleep. "Tell me what's happening across the street," asked Nick when he woke in the morning. But there was no answer. After asking several more times with no reply, he called the nurse. It happened that deep in the night, Joshua had died. And Nick cried the whole day. As evening approached and the nurse came into his room, he asked her if she would look out the window and tell him what was happening at the festival across the street. "I don't understand," replied the nurse. "Just look out the window and tell me what you see," returned Nick. "What window?" she replied. "The window by Joshua's bed," cried Nick. "I'm sorry, Nick. There are no windows in this room." Nick got the nurse to get him out of bed and take him over to Joshua's bed, where he traced the wall along the bedside. No window. He sat there for a while wondering. The whole thing had been imagined. The festival, the people, the star, even the window itself, all just made up out of Joshua's head. And then Nick turned and he faced the nurse and he asked, "How long until I am well enough to leave?" "As soon as you learn how to walk with a cane," she replied. And then she added, "What's the hurry?" "There's an ad for help wanted, and I need to apply." A story, any story, whether it be about Santa or wise men or babes born in mangers or blind men following Christmas festivals, need not be real to be true. All that is required of them to be true is for them to ignite a spark of hope or purpose or courage or generosity or kindness within us in the very moments where we feel most without those qualities. It is not what we make of the stories that matter. It is what they make of us. You know the truth about Santa, right? Well, know this. Christmas, for all its sham and pretension, obligation and drudgery, for all the things about it that seem unreal, it is still true. As long as it calls forth from within us some spirit that makes us willing to follow an unseen star, carrying our presence toward an unseen birth in very real ways. When we give gifts to cultivate a spirit of generosity toward those in need, it calls us to be true despite any lack of truth we may feel around us or any lack of truth we may feel within us. And it calls me personally to lift up this fact. Many of the truest things I have ever known never actually happened. Remembering that has helped me walk through a great many moments of despair and cynicism and doubt to the glory of life.